From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, political asylum in the U.S. Who gets it and who decides? We talk with filmmakers Shari Robertson and Michael Camerini about their new documentary, Well-Founded Fear. They were granted unprecedented access to the offices of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, where they filmed the fateful interviews between asylum officers and the refugees seeking asylum in the U.S. And we talk about the difficulties of evaluating the refugee stories and deciding whether to grant asylum with one of the officers featured in the film, Gerald Brown. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. FBI agents are searching for the source of a computer software virus that swamped email systems and damaged other files around the world today. The virus has been dubbed the love bug because it lures recipients with a subject heading that says, "I love you." Some experts estimate that the virus infected tens of millions of computers from Asia through Europe to the United States. In addition to overwhelming email systems, the virus reportedly destroys computer files, including those that store pictures, video, and music. Experts say that recipients should delete the message without opening it. Arizona Senator John McCain and two Democrats are calling for a commission to help ensure that Social Security remains solvent. The group is embracing the concept of investing retirement funds in the stock market. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
McCain says the whole point of yet another Social Security commission is to take politics out of the issue by creating an independent body analogous to the base closing commission. Flanked by Democrats Bob Kerry and Daniel Patrick Moynihan, McCain refused to attack Vice President Al Gore, who has blasted George W. Bush's endorsement of private investment of some Social Security money.
What we're doing here is not to beat up on the vice president. I will do that at another time with ferocity.
McCain meets with Governor Bush Tuesday in Pittsburgh, and Social Security reform will be on the agenda. Moments later, in an example of just the kind of political attack McCain is worried about, New York Democrat Charles Schumer echoed Gore's comments about Bush's, quote, secret Social Security plan that he says would destabilize the system. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Lebanese Hezbollah guerrillas launched volleys of Katyusha rockets into northern Israel today, hurting at least five people. Fighting has intensified over the past week, even as Israel prepares to end its 22-year occupation of southern Lebanon. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Beirut.
Hezbollah says the Katyushas are retaliation for the latest in a string of attacks by Israel's proxy militia here. Artillery fire this morning killed an elderly woman and her daughter as they slept. Yesterday, a dozen Lebanese civilians were wounded in an attack Israel called a mistake. Hezbollah's response tonight was its harshest in months. The tit-for-tat came as a United Nations special envoy was in Beirut trying to coordinate Israel's planned pullout by July. For the first time, Lebanon and Syria, the power broker here, say they want UN peacekeepers to patrol the border. It's a welcome reversal, but UN officials still worry they'll get caught in crossfire. Israel's proxy army and Hezbollah guerrillas make no promises to disarm. Jennifer Lutton, NPR News, Beirut.
In stocks, the Dow Industrials lost 67 points today to close at 10,413 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Kent State University in Ohio held a commemoration today for the four students killed and nine wounded by National Guard troops during a Vietnam War protest 30 years ago. Survivors of the shooting say they still don't know why the Ohio National Guard opened fire on them. Today's anniversary marks the first time all nine of the wounded have been reunited since the shooting. Prosecutors in Los Angeles have dismissed felony charges against six more men in the latest cases connected to the corruption scandal at the police department's Rampart Division. NPR's Aaron Schachter reports.
The decision was made today by Superior Court Judge Larry Fidler. So far, 73 felony convictions have been overturned at the request of prosecutors in one of the worst scandals in police department history. About 30 police officers have been relieved of duty as a result of the ongoing investigation. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles City Attorney's Office sent letters today notifying defense lawyers that misdemeanor cases involving 234 people are under review in the wake of the scandal. Also today, L.A. Police Chief Bernard Parks announced a new department booking procedure that requires a watch commander to approve all arrests before suspects are booked. Aaron Schachter, NPR News, Los Angeles.
At the Lockerbie bombing trial today in the Netherlands, residents of the small Scottish town testified about the night in 1988 when burning debris and bodies rained down on them. Lockerbie residents described the crash as pieces of bomb-blasted planes fell on houses and yards. The bombing killed a total of 270 people, including 11 on the ground. I'm Corey Flintoff. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As we hear the news about Aileen Gonzalez and the Haitian refugees who were shipwrecked while trying to make their way to the U.S., a new documentary is exploring the issue of political asylum in the U.S., who deserves asylum, who gets it, and who decides. The film's title, Well-Founded Fear, comes from the criteria used to determine if someone is worthy. Asylum seekers must demonstrate a well-founded fear that if they return to their country, they will be persecuted for their political opinions, nationality, religion, race, or social group. The documentary will be shown this weekend at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema and will be broadcast on the PBS POV series on June 5th. A little later, we'll talk about the difficulties of determining who gets asylum with a former asylum officer. My first guests are the directors of Well-Founded Fear, Sherry Robertson and Michael Camerini. They obtained permission to film within the offices of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Asylum seekers must already be in the U.S. Many are here illegally. I asked Michael Camerini about the origins of asylum.
Asylum's origins have, in its sort of modern legal form, have to do with the fact that this country and many other countries sent people back, sent Jews back to Germany to their death. That there was a period where countries were perfectly comfortable refusing entry to people who were in desperate danger. And it's sort of the memory and the history of that created modern asylum. It's this idea that you won't send somebody back to trouble.
So the idea of asylum is pretty new?
As an idea, it's not especially new. As a codified international treaty, it dates back, I think, to 1951. It was drawn up as part of the Geneva Convention.
You know, we always say the pilgrims, if they arrived today, would be absolutely qualified for asylum. So it's a long tradition in this country.
Your film focuses around interviews conducted by asylum officers with people seeking asylum. What was the typical interview process like? How would you describe it after having observed many of them?
Well, the typical asylum interview takes place on a day when the officer has at least two other interviews to do that morning. So they tend to run around an hour, although there's no set limit. The officer has a few minutes to look over a file before they walk out into a waiting room full of people from everywhere and usually mispronounce a name of somebody from another place. And then they go in together. The applicant may have a lawyer or may have a translator, but they sit across a desk, and the officer checks on the information that's been submitted in a file, and then pretty much in an individual way does a small interview to try to find out whether the applicant actually has an asylum claim and then whether the claim that they are presenting is in fact true.
You've got an hour and you're asking someone about their life, and you need to figure out where to ask your question, what to focus on. And we saw a huge range of interview styles. And people come with their life story. And for many people, what happened to their parents is part of their history in terms of their relationship with their government. And many people want to start telling you the month-by-month story beginning in 1947. The officer's got to figure out how to get to the answer, which is, do I believe this person? Does this person qualify? Did what happened to them, does it fit the law? Should they still be afraid, even if they were afraid before? There's this mental calculation you can see each officer do. What's going to help me figure out whether this person goes in kind of in this basket or this basket?
Well, much of your movie, Well-Founded Fear, focuses around interviews between caseworkers for the Immigration and Naturalization Service and men and women who are seeking asylum in the United States. I thought I'd play a short example of one of these encounters. We're going to hear from Anna Maria, a woman from Romania who's seeking asylum in the United States on the grounds that she says she was discriminated against because of her religion, which is Anglican. The caseworker interviewing her is named Peter.
My difficulties start after they officially knew that I'm a member of the Anglican Church. My husband was stopped on the street one night when he came home, and he was severely beaten.
When was that?
In November.
Of 96?
Of 96, yes. And he was told, that he was told in his face when he ran, because he managed to run. Mm-hmm. He defended himself and he managed to run. Otherwise, he would have been more severely beaten. And he was told that because he was beaten because of me, it was an advertisement given to me. And if I will return in Romania, I will be raped and he will be killed. After that, my house was searched, and also they wrote on my walls, "Out, you Anglican."
Okay. And at what point did you inform them that you were Anglican?
I didn't show them any paper. I was not supposed to do that, to show them papers that I'm Anglican, that I was received.
So it was just a casual conversation?
It was, yes, it was. You asked me when it was the first time. Mm-hmm. They have found exactly and officially that I'm Anglican.
Mm-hmm. How did they find that out?
We'll get to that point. After my bags
This is my interview, not yours, okay? How did you... Don't worry, she's not antagonizing. Okay. Don't worry about it. Just want to backtrack a little bit. One thing I wanted to ask you before, and I had forgotten. What are the sacraments that the Anglican Church recognizes?
It's Holy Communion, mm-hmm. and it's Holy Trinity.
In what language was the Anglican service conducted in Romania?
In English.
Who's the head of the Anglican Church?
The head of the Anglican Church in Romania is...
Overall,
it's a bishop. Bishop of Gibraltar, he's called. Now he's Bishop John of Gibraltar.
Well, that's an excerpt of the documentary Well-Founded Fear about asylum. And my guests are the filmmaker Sherry Roberts and Michael Camerini. Now, listening to that, when I was watching your movie, I was thinking, you know, how would I decide? Do I think she's credible? And, you know, she's not... She's not being very dramatic. She's not crying. A lot of the people really just kind of lose control and break down as they're recounting their story. She seems a little hesitant when discussing what the sacraments are. So, you know, you are probably wondering a little bit how true is the story she's telling. The caseworker didn't grant her asylum. He referred her to a judge who would then decide. And I think 90% of the time when it's referred to a judge, the person is turned down. Let me play the clip from your documentary in which he explains some of his reasons for turning her down for asylum.
You know, I can understand a desire to stay here. She could make a much better life for herself here, but that's not grounds for asylum. A lot of people would like to come here and better their lives, but it's not grounds for asylum. How many Anglicans do you know don't know that the Archbishop of Canterbury is the head of the Anglican Church? And how many Anglicans do you know don't know the sacraments in the Anglican Church? If she claims that she went there every week and took communion.
Well, let me ask you, what happened to his decision?
His decision was reversed in court. We were in correspondence with Bishop John, who sent us back an email to our phrasing of the officer's question. He said, of course, the head of the Anglican Church is our Lord Jesus Christ. But after that, the bishops are a college among equals, and it isn't like the Catholic Church. And in fact, there is a Bishop John called the Bishop of Gibraltar, although he lives in a suburb of London, and he is in fact the head of all Anglican churches in continental Europe. So, and the Archbishop of Canterbury is first among equals. So at some level, they're both right. There's sort of a clarifying thing one should say. The law gives you a second chance if you're turned down, and it's a de novo hearing. So in theory, the judge made his own mind up, not necessarily on the basis of the same set of questions. Recent legislation has moved the American system away from that, towards less review, towards one person alone really making the decision. That's a subtext of the movie, if you like, the dangers of that.
For an asylum case officer who's hearing a story that sounds, you know, murky, ambiguous, they're not sure whether they're getting the truth or not, what does the law say about doubt? Which side do you rule on?
The instructions and the training to asylum officers are very clear. If you are doubtful, if you cannot be certain, you should grant. There aren't that many officers who necessarily uphold that at the highest level.
My guests are Michael Camerini and Sherry Robertson, directors of the new documentary Well-Founded Fear. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests Michael Camerini and Sherry Robertson made the new documentary Well-Founded Fear about political asylum in the U.S. What percentage of people who apply for asylum are actually granted it?
The Asylum Corps, as you see it in the movie, has only been in existence for about 10 years. When they started, you could get work authorization by applying for asylum, so an awful lot of people had applications sent in who didn't even know they were applying for asylum, and that meant that the grant rate was pretty low. When we were shooting in 1997 and 98, the average nationwide was about 20% who were granted. I think it's gone up since we finished shooting because there have been a lot of restrictions imposed on who can apply, and many fewer people are applying, but about 30% are being granted now.
What happens to the people who are denied asylum?
If you're denied asylum in this affirmative process, you can appeal. If you are turned down by the judge, there are still some avenues of appeal. Very often people agree to voluntary departure. The truth is that we are, as a country, deporting large numbers of people, but the concentration of the INS has been on people who have a criminal record. The 96 law made that a pretty loose definition, so that people are being deported if they are here and 10 years ago they committed a relatively minor offense. But the problem is, if you're like Christian Jickman in the film, if you're a person who has built up a life here while waiting for their interview, or you have kids in school, or you're paying taxes, life becomes very, very difficult. If you're a young person who's working hourly labor, going underground is certainly what you're likely to do.
You mean remain here as an illegal?
Right.
Well, you're really worse off than if you were just here as an illegal or an undocumented person, because that way you can remain fairly anonymous. Once you've applied for asylum, your fingerprints are on file, and you've been ordered to leave. So if you are picked up for anything, you're pretty likely to be put into detention and then deported.
Now, your film about asylum, Well-Founded Fear, has recently been released against the backdrop of the Alien Gonzalez story. So having immersed yourself in issues pertaining to immigration and asylum. What are your thoughts on the Elian Gonzalez story?
If Elian were another little boy from another place, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, this story would have never become a story. He would have been dried off and taken care of and sent home within a matter of hours. Cuba's always had a special relationship with the United States, and Cubans who've come here have been a very particular group in terms of asylum and immigration issues. But I don't think most people were aware of that until Elian came along.
In a way, one of the things that prompted us to make this film was the realization that until the end of the Cold War, there was this kind of secret pact. The bad guys wouldn't let their people out, and every time one of them came here, we gave them asylum, and we got points for it. After the Cold War, you don't get points anymore. People are on the move all over, and there's no geopolitical benefit. It's just about your commitment to human rights, as a country. And the Elian Gonzalez case is this case out of that other history. It really isn't about the modern reality of asylum, which is Americans aren't aware of the institution, there is no political advantage, and fear about immigration and the anti-immigration lobby leads Congress to compromise on human rights of refugees.
When you say that it used to be more clear-cut, if you were from a bad guy country, we'd accept you and get points. But by that you mean if you were from a communist nation and the communists were our enemy, we would accept you. And now that the Cold War is over, the world isn't divided that way anymore.
We used to call them defectors. And there were ballet dancers from Russia, and there were musicians from Eastern Europe. But there weren't very many at all.
But now that civil war is tearing up such a good part of the world and people are desperate to get out of their countries, it's very different.
It's very different, and civil war is a particularly interesting part of the asylum question, because unless you can prove that you were persecuted for something to do with you individually, personally, a civil war is almost the worst place to come from and ask for asylum.
Because it's just a condition of life there. It has nothing to do with your individual persecution.
Right. The burden of proof is much, much higher. So even if your life is in real danger, you have a harder time proving that you deserve asylum than a person who was beaten up in the Soviet Union because they were Jewish, for example.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Sherry Robertson and Michael Camerini's film Well-Founded Fear will be shown on the PBS POV series June 5th. My guest Gerald Brown was an asylum officer with the INS from 1994 to 98. He's featured in the documentary Well-Founded Fear. He now works as a consultant with refugee and immigration programs. Brown has worked with refugees for most of his career. I asked him why he wanted to work as an asylum officer.
Because I think that the asylum officer's job is very important, and in a lot of ways it's the best job I ever had. You get to study country conditions, you get to study the law, and you get to apply it to refugees and determine their fates. So for a lot of reasons, I thought it was a great job.
Well, you know, in the film Well-Founded Fear, some of the asylum officers expressed the opinion that that they were lied to a fair amount by people seeking asylum who embellished or altered their story to fit with the regulations to qualify for asylum. Did you feel that way, that people often lied to you?
Yes, I think it's very clear that the majority of cases you see people are, you know, lying or enhancing the truth because they desperately want asylum. But that doesn't mean, number one, that they don't deserve asylum, and it certainly doesn't mean that they're bad people. I mean, most people in this world are just trying to get what you and I already have. You know, we live in a place where we can pretty much do whatever we want to with our lives if we're willing to work for it. And that's a rarity in this world. So one of the most important things that an asylum officer needed to do was to be able to listen to three people, you know, lie, and then when the fourth person was interviewed, to be able to listen to them in such a way that you didn't assume that they were lying. And if the you determined the person was lying, you had to make a decision of whether it was relevant to the case. You know, often the lies had nothing to do with whether they were, you know, real refugees or not.
I mean, they might be persecuted for their religion, and they're embellishing it with lies. But even if you strip the lies away, they're still being persecuted for their religion.
Yes, ma'am. Or they were persecuted for something else, and some, you know, shady lawyer or preparer, you know, told them to say something else. So our job was to strip through all the stuff and try to find out the truth of whether these folks had a well-founded fear of persecution because of one of the five grounds.
So you're saying that these people are often coached a lot by,
yes,
by their lawyers, and the coaching isn't sometimes very good.
Well, right, and this not only lawyers but preparers, people in the community that you know, they found their way to, who helped them prepare their asylum application. A Chinese person, for example, who might have suffered real persecution because of he was Catholic and practiced his religion. But the preparer would say, no, no, don't say that. Say that you were persecuted because of the one-child policy. Because that's, you know, and the person, having no clue, would do what the preparer said.
So,
does that make sense?
Yeah, but how do you get the person to try to tell you the truth after they've been coached to lie?
Well, you would tear down the lie and then, you know, but go on and say, listen, did anything else happen to you? What really happened to you to make you leave your country? And oftentimes, if you were willing to do that, you know, the person would come up with a very believable story. I think what good officers do is, you know, try to find out what the real story is.
Gerald Brown is a former asylum officer with the INS. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Time, this week in Time magazine, coverage of the antitrust case against Microsoft and viewpoints of what will happen next. Information at time.com. Random House, Inc., Crown Publishers Division. Hardcover publishers of Ordinary Resurrections, Children in the Years of Hope by Jonathan Kozol. By Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And by Random House Inc.'s Dial Press Division, publisher of The Running Mate, a new novel of politics by Joe Klein, author of Primary Colors. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Listening for the Truth. We continue our interview with Gerald Brown, a former asylum officer with the INS, who interviewed refugees seeking political asylum in this country and evaluated their stories. He's featured in the new documentary, Well-Founded Fear.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Gerald Brown, who has worked with refugees for most of his career. From 1994 to 98, he was an asylum officer with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, where he interviewed refugees seeking political asylum and determined whether to grant them asylum. He's featured in the new documentary, Well-Founded Fear. Here's a clip from the film featuring a different asylum officer interviewing a refugee from El Salvador seeking political asylum.
Sacaron a la esposa de mi hermano.
They took my brother's wife.
Que solamente ella se encontraba en la casa.
She was the only one in the house.
Y la llevaron a un río que se llama Salguate. Está
they
cerca de esa colonia.
To a river, which name is Salguate, close to that neighborhood.
Entonces ahí la torturaron.
They tortured her.
Seguramente suponemos para sacarle más información.
We think that because they want more information.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just take your time. Yeah. Take your time.
Toma su tiempo. Toma su tiempo, okay?
Perdone.
It's okay.
Excuse me.
That's all right. Just take your time.
Do you have a Kleenex?
No.
Thank you. A ella la torturaron.
They tortured her.
Mm-hmm.
Le desarmaron. Le abrieron.
They destroyed the. They opened the face.
Mm-hmm.
Luego la pusieron boca abajo.
They put her down.
Mm-hmm.
Le dieron
down.
6 disparos
and
en la espalda.
They gave her 6 shots in the back.
That was a refugee from El Salvador with her translator. Let's get back to our interview with former asylum officer Gerald Brown. Now, when you were hearing all of these stories as an asylum officer, I mean, you're hearing just heartrending stories, and true, some of them are lies, but a lot of them are true.
Right.
And it's your job to be as impartial and really as unemotional as possible and just impartially evaluate what's true and who's worthy of asylum. Is it hard to be that unemotional and impartial when you're hearing these horrible, tragic stories?
Well, I think the movie tells us very clearly that it is very, very difficult, but not for the apparent reason. I mean, you're probably, when you say that, you probably mean, well, isn't it hard to not, you know, that you'd be so upset? How do you make the decision? But how it plays out is people become, they use cynicism as a defense mechanism. So people that you saw that were very jaded in the film are jaded because they have to do something, I think, to protect themselves from all the horror stories that they hear. And one of the easiest ways to do that is say, oh, well, they're all lying anyway, you know. And then you don't have to internalize all the pain that you have to deal with.
Did you often wonder how the refugees saw you? You know, in the countries that they're fleeing from, the people in government capacity are often the people who are out to get them or to persecute them. And here you are representing the government, but you're trying to give them a fair hearing. But maybe they saw you more the way they saw people in the government of their home countries, as someone who's their enemy.
Yeah, I think that's one of the fundamental difficulties is, you know, that you are dealing with people who are resentful of and afraid of authority. You know, they come through the asylum officer doors, and there's the big flag and the big seal. And there's an armed guard to meet them, and they have to sit in this enclosed space. So, yeah, I think it's pretty hard for them to, you know, to be open and trustful.
In the documentary Well-Founded Fear, you're hearing the case of an Algerian woman who's seeking asylum, and she feels that her life is in danger, as are the lives of everyone in her family. And there's a part where she tells her translator that her parents were well-known political activists, but that part of the story doesn't really get translated to you. Did that affect your decision to not give her asylum?
Well, I didn't. Are you saying that I didn't hear it in the interview? It wasn't translated?
Right.
Well, obviously, that would have an effect. But if that had been translated, I would try to make her tell me how to demonstrate that that was a fact. That they were indeed politically prominent. And if I had established that, then I very well may have granted her. Your point being that translation's important, I suppose.
Yeah, very. It must be very important.
It is important. One of the basic decisions made when the asylum court was put together was that the government couldn't afford to, furnish all these folks with translators, that they had to bring their own. Well, this is how, that money-saving effort kind of backfires.
Can you give us an example of someone who you really would have liked to give asylum to, but technically you couldn't do it?
Yeah, that lady.
Well, tell us more for our listeners who haven't seen the movie. Tell us more about her story.
Yeah, it was an Algerian woman who was obviously very upset, who had one little child on her lap and had another one in her belly. And if you could kind of, follow your heart, she was an automatic grant. But she did not establish, a well-founded fear on account of the grounds during the interview to my satisfaction. So I was obligated, in my mind, to, follow the law, which is the asylum officer's best friend. You've got to apply the law, or you get so, far asee that you're lost without hope. So you've got to follow the law all the time if you're going to be a good officer. And, I did that. But I wished in my heart that I could grant her.
Yeah, in the film you say that you know that she's going to face problems, but it's just the typical problems that any woman in Algeria would face.
Well, it's not any woman.
Any person.
Yes, ma'am, because if it had been woman, then that would have been a different thing. But everybody who lives in Algeria lives under, a degree of fear. Every single soul. And the law is that the circumstances have to be unique in some way, specifically in the five ways that we've listed. And I thought that she was afraid, but I didn't know that she was any more afraid than the rest of the populace.
You have interviewed people from many different countries, many different cultures. Were there certain things you started to learn about cultural ways of telling a story or cultural differences in what's private and what's public, what you reveal and what you don't, that affected how you interpreted the truthfulness of what somebody was telling you?
Well, yeah. I mean, generally speaking, the answer is, of course. I'm trying to think of good examples. The one that comes to mind, obviously, is, as a man, a first world white man interviewing a third world black woman about stuff that often had to do with sexual abuse and stuff. They tell the story differently than I would tell the story. Hopefully because of my experience and because, I've got a lot of respect for what women in general have to go through. I was sensitive to that and did, a fairly good job. That's one of the obvious areas.
Mm-hmm. When you were an asylum officer and people would have to tell you the story of how they were persecuted and why they fled their country, what were some of the things you observed about what it was like for people to relive the story as they told it?
Most people, there was a kid in the movie who kind of chuckled when he talked about having to drink from a toilet. And they interviewed his lawyer after. And I've heard that people have reacted, you know, have had negative reactions who have seen the film to that kid, you know, saying stuff like, well, he's obviously was lying because he wouldn't be giggling. Well, that's not my experience. People did giggle. They get nervous, and they would act like that kid acted. I thought that was very authentic. You've had also the Salvadoran woman who was interviewed in the movie was typical and very, very sad, I thought. She was shy, but she was obviously very distraught. And, you know, an asylum interview is one of the few times that you do talk about things like that lady and like that kid went through. And it is very, very touching. And you want to just hug them, you know, and make everything all right. That's why it's so frustrating after going through an interview like that when a supervisor tells you that it's not a grant because they weren't there. They didn't look in the eyes of the person, and they don't know.
My guest is Gerald Brown, a former asylum officer with the INS. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gerald Brown, a former asylum officer with the INS. His job was to interview refugees and determine whether they qualified for political asylum in the U.S. What percentage of the people whose stories you heard did you grant asylum to?
Well, I was it was one of my problems. I granted more than most people do. I might have granted, I don't know, maybe a quarter. But the average granted is more like 10%, I would guess.
And were you criticized by your supervisor at the INS for granting it to too many people?
Oh, yes, that was a constant battle in that particular office. And it wasn't so much the supervisor depended on which one you had. They always rotated. And some supervisors at the New York office were, you know, were easier to please than others. But the director and the associate director were constantly on me for granting too many people.
You quit the Immigration and Naturalization Service shortly after the shooting for the documentary was done. Why did you quit?
I quit because I got tired of fighting the management about my decisions. I got tired of half of the energy I spent in my job was arguing with management about whether I could grant somebody or not. And it just became clear to me that if, you know, as long as I stayed, I would have to fight. And after a while, you start becoming tempted to just go with the flow, you know. Heck, if they want a referral, just refer them. Life would be so much simpler. And when you feel that coming on, it's time to get out. And so I would go back to the asylum corps, not in the New York office with the management they've got, but I would go back. But I needed a break from that office, so that's why I quit.
I'm wondering if your experience working as an asylum officer changed your thinking about who should qualify for asylum and what that process ought to be.
I don't really think that it did change my opinion. Before I was an asylum officer, I worked in the refugee advocacy community for, you know, 15 years. And I have to say that after the asylum thing didn't change my attitude. I understand that there have to be laws that, you know, dictate who is granted asylum. I may not agree with all the laws, But I believe that after the law is passed, that, you know, it should be implemented fairly and evenly and seriously. And I believe that then. I believe that now. I don't know what further to say. I think that the best you could hope for is that, you know, the laws that Congress sees fit to pass are fairly applied to everybody.
You have worked with refugees for over 15 years, and I know it seems that your heart is really with helping refugees come to, you know, stay in America and adjust to America. And I'm wondering if you could talk with us at all about your thinking of how many refugees we can really accommodate. Do you know what I mean? Like what?
Yes, ma'am.
Whether we should have completely open doors in the best of all possible worlds, or whether that's just an impossibility, and you have to, that's why you have to have standards and you have to have limits.
Yeah, I'm probably not going to give you the answer that I have. Isn't an answer at all. It's a complicated response. I don't think I'm not for necessarily for bringing refugees to the United States. I think that refugees should be helped. And I think that it depends on the situation of how you help them. That's for refugees. On immigrants, generally, I think that as long as the United States is rich and free and other places aren't, and the population of the world keeps growing, then people will come to the United States. I don't care what you do. And so I think that the answer is helping the rest of the world, the standard of living, come up to the United States. If you're not willing to do that, then you might as well, you know, quit fighting, because that is the only way that's going to stop immigration. So all of the talk about, you know, what are the right numbers and all this stuff really don't get to the point. The point is that if you want to cut immigration, you've got to help folks have a decent living where they are.
Now, you were working in Macedonia during the bombing of Kosovo. You were helping ethnic Albanian refugees from Kosovo in preparation for asylum interviews to determine their eligibility to resettle in the U.S. Now, there's a situation where, like, there's a whole population of people who are being persecuted. How do you determine who's more worthy than the next person in a situation where it truly is a whole population?
Well, that is the U.S. government, the State Department, sets criteria for populations like that. I mean, it's their legal, you know, responsibility to do it. And they usually do it based on family reunification factors and on dire need. So they will set the criteria. They'll say, you know, special medical cases for kids and people who have spouses living in the U.S., for example. And then once they've set that, then you interview accordingly.
What was it like for you to interview people in the refugee camps as opposed to, you know, in an INS office in New York?
It's very different. I mean, the worst situation I've ever been in is I was in Croatia in 1992 when Bosnians from the Serb concentration camps were being released and bused into Croatia.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really... That was really it's pretty damn sad. After that, everything that I've ever seen, you know, kind of is easy. But it is different than interviewing in an office in New York City, although you can see some pretty sad people there as well.
My guest is Gerald Brown, a former asylum officer with the INS. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Gerald Brown, a former asylum officer with the INS. His job was to interview refugees and determine whether they qualified for political asylum in the U.S. He's featured in the new documentary, Well-Founded Fear. You know, in the documentary, Well-Founded Fear, about people seeking asylum and the asylum officers who make the decisions about asylum, you really look like, excuse me for saying this, you look like the prototype of a WASP, you know, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. You're there with your bow tie, certain kind of glasses. It looks like the dictionary definition of that the stereotype of the WASP. And so I couldn't help looking at you wondering, it looks like, this is probably a totally false impression, but it looks like your ancestors probably came over on the Mayflower. So what's your personal connection to immigration? Do you have one?
Well, I come from a long, proud line of poor white trash in North Carolina, so I can identify with refugees from that perspective. I saw injustice in rural North Carolina with black folks, and you don't have to be, real smart to pick up that that was pretty unfair. But I guess I was in Egypt in 1976 for a couple of years working with poor folks there, and that's where I was, I guess, my direction was set. You just really figure out, or I did anyway, that the world is an unfair place and that, you know, it's just by the luck of the draw that I was born a white male and the United States. So it kind of went from there. Also, Jesse James is an old relative of mine, and I'm a little bit Cherokee, so not as WASPy as I look, maybe.
Did you kind of cultivate the image that I was describing?
The bow tie thing I did because, you know, when I found out that I was going to have to wear a tie every day, I decided I'd be kind of, I might as well be spiffy about it. The rest of it, I don't think I did, not consciously anyway.
I'm wondering what your thoughts have been about the Alien Gonzalez story. And here's specifically what I'm wondering. There are so many people who have gotten so caught up in the story of one boy and his family.
Right.
And a lot of people who really, want to make sure that he gets to stay here.
Right.
And I suspect that a lot of those people are people who are otherwise really kind of opposed to open immigration policies.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I've had a hard time, paying much attention to that case. I was in Guantanamo in 1994 when the Haitian refugees were being held there, and then Cubans were held there as well. And the difference in the way that the two populations were treated was pretty striking. Also, the Cuban-American lobby is one of the strongest in the United States, and that they're going to support their cause with energy and enthusiasm. So, again, I get back to let's apply the law the same everywhere. And, the law is very clear. They should have sent the kid back. And that's it.
You've worked with Haitian refugees. And I'm wondering your thoughts when you read about the recent shipwrecks of Haitians who were trying to get to America by boat.
Right. Well, I'm saddened. I have a special place in my heart for Haitians, but there have to be, laws, and the law says, you can't blame the people for, trying to get out of there. Have you ever been to Haiti?
I have not.
Yeah, it's a hell of a place. You can't. Anybody in their right mind would probably try to leave, especially if you have a relative, in a better place, which most of these folks do. On the other hand, there's no easy answer of what to do except what I said before. I mean, I think that, we need to get in there and help the folks make Haiti a livable place. Then they quit drowning themselves.
You've done a lot of work resettling refugees in the United States.
Yeah.
And it must be very difficult finding work that fits the qualifications they had in their old countries. I mean, for instance, I think there's a lot of professionals from other countries who come to the United States without a lot of skills in speaking English, who end up having to do things like drive taxis or be waiters or busboys or janitors, as opposed to being the kinds of professionals or business people they were able to be in their own countries.
Yeah, that's true that's an issue. I never, you know, worried about it too much, quite frankly, because, I mean, if you've got enough savvy to be a refugee and get yourself out of the messes that they get out of, you kind of know that they're going to figure out a way to thrive here sooner or later. The more difficult case is the, you know, the Cambodian peasant who you're trying to get a job and who can't figure out how to get up the escalator. That's more of a challenge. I worried about that more than the other.
Now, you're living in Utah now. Is there much of an immigrant community there?
No, ma'am, there's not. We came out here to, you know, to get away from New York for a while, and because the place is probably the prettiest place I've ever seen. But I think that our tenure here is going to end in the fall, and we'll go back to a city. There are no immigrants here. I'm doing refugee consultation, but it's via, you know, telephones and fax machines and email.
What countries would you most not like to live in?
Oh, Jesus, there are a whole host that I wouldn't go near. Algeria is one of them, the one that I sent the lady back to. God. But some of the sub-Saharan African countries, I wouldn't want to be a black person in Mauritania. That may be my number one place.
Gerald Brown, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Gerald Brown is featured in the new documentary about political asylum, Well-Founded Fear. It will be broadcast on PBS June 5th. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House, Inc., Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Ordinary Resurrections, Children in the Years of Hope, by Jonathan Kozel. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the Internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide, at www.alcatel.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Mother of My Mother, The Intricate Bond Between Generations, by Hope Edelman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Autumn in New York, why does it seem so inviting?
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Dawn Upshaw. This month she premieres a new show of American popular song at Lincoln Center. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for Fresh Air.